is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Peter Brimelow. Peter, it is great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
And I'm also joined here with Alex Von Goldstein.
It's great to be speaking with you guys today.
Hi, Alex.
To start things off, Peter, could you tell us about the history of VDare, your background in journalism prior to setting up VDare, and what are some of the issues that inspired you to set up VDare?
Well, Robert, as you can tell from my accent, I'm originally from England. I came here in 1970 to go to the business school at Stanford, but it didn't really take, and I reverted to this half world of financial journalism, where I, you know, existed for the next 40 odd years. But I was always interested in the immigration question, partly because I was immensely influenced by Enoch Powell when I was living in England, when I was a kid in England. You know, not just on the immigration side, but also in terms of classical liberal economics, which in those days were completely in eclipse in England, and of course are now perhaps deservedly going into eclipse again in the U.S. Anyway, mutated into being more of a conservative journalist, a polemicist. I sort of gradually came out of my financial journalism briar patch and wrote more and more about economic, more and more about political issues, usually with an economic twist.
At what age did you kind of convert from being a liberal to a conservative?
I was never a liberal. I was always a conservative. I guess I basically come from, what in Britain we used to be called working class Toryism. We were in the great strength of the Conservative Party in Britain through the end of the 19th century and right at the 20th century was it had a real grip on the English working class because it was a nationalist party. Now, this is the theme that you will recognize because, of course, it's what Trump is all about. And so I was never a liberal, and I was always... The only reason I got interested in pre-market economics was as a phenomenon, really. It was just a way of getting at the left, which was regarded as an anti-national force in Britain and in the U.S. But I still think, I do think, and I think Powell's right about this, that there are real insights in the free market, but they're not necessarily left-wing insights. But that's not what conservatism is all about, it's pre-market. In any event, I was very close to the editor of National Review, John O'Sullivan, and from about 1988 through about 1997, I wrote a lot for National Review, and I wrote on the immigration question, which is something that's been on my mind for more than 30 years because of Powell's influence and because of my own experiences in coming through the immigration process in the U.S. You know, immigrants, by and large, are not romantic about immigration. It's only American intellectuals who are romantic about immigration. Anybody who's been through the process can see what a total bog up it is. And how paradoxically it works. In any event, around about 1996, I did this article for National Review in 1992, a cover story called Time to Rethink Immigration. And for about 5 years, we broke with the sort of Conservative Inc. Wall Street Journal consensus and argued in favor of immigration restriction. And then around about 1997, the summer of 1997, Buckley very, very unexpectedly fired John and purged us all from National Review. And there was a period in there of 2 or 3 years when it was literally impossible to get facts and analysis about immigration, the immigration disaster, out. It's hard to believe now, but in those days, you know, because of the internet really hadn't gotten started, there was just no way of getting the most elementary facts, such as, for example, the consensus among labor economists is that immigration is of no value to America and then American native born, it doesn't make them any better off. It doesn't do anything that they could have done for themselves. And that's been the consensus for 25 years, but it simply was never penetrated the public discourse because it was simply shut out by people at the Wall Street Journal and so on, my former colleagues at the Wall Street Journal and so on. In any event, but fortunately the internet came along and there were people who regretted or didn't like Buckley's change, of course, who put money up, and we started VDares.com. I launched on Christmas Eve of 1999.
Did it automatically go to the web, or was it originally a written magazine at first?
No, it was never what we call a three-zine. It was always on the internet. In the initial days, I worked closely with Scott McConnell, who eventually went on to found the American Conservative, and that was a point of disagreement between us. I always believed that I always thought the internet was the way of the future, and Scott did not. And so eventually he persuaded Targi, Theodore Kofler to put up quite a lot of money for the American Conservative. And for several years, Targi put in $1.5 million a year there. In my opinion, a waste. It should have been focused on the internet. And of course, Targi now runs his own, has his own webzine, Targi Mag, which I think is a great product.
Yeah, me too.
What do you see as the principal driving forces behind mass immigration? Would you say it's primarily economic, or are there other major factors as well?
Why is it that the first world submits to immigration? I mean, obviously there are push factors in the third world, and Steve Saylor has written very eloquently about the tremendous demographic disaster shaping up in Africa. Population growth is outrunning resources there, and that's partly a result of Western medicine slowly filtering into that area. But the real reason is, why does some countries in the first world, but not all of them, for example, in Japan, give into it? And that has to be cultural. There's simply no economic. And as I say, I've been a fan of journalists for 40 years, and so I actually, when I wrote my book, Alien Nation, in 95, we flowed out of the immigration story I did for National Review. You know, I spent a great deal of time looking at the economic issues, and there's no economic case for this great influx of population. It's not going to benefit the native born at all.
It doesn't benefit the native born of the population, but it benefits the special interest, like groups
I mean, that's really the point. It causes tremendous redistribution of wealth within the native born community. You can't show that in aggregate the native born community is better off because of immigration, but because most of the increased GDP as a result of immigration goes to the immigrants themselves in the form of wages. But it does cause a tremendous redistribution of income within the native-born population. Basically, it shifts when I last looked, 2 to 3% of GDP from labor to capital, and that really explains what's going on. It can be explained in very crude Marxist terms. It's an attack on the living standards of the working class of the first world, and of course that means in turn that it benefits a lot of highly intellectual people who want to keep it going. Now, that's not the only reason, of course. I mean, if it was just up to economics alone, this problem would have been resolved years ago. The problem is that there are deep-seated cultural reasons the first world, people, intellectuals and so on in the first world, want to keep this going. And that will take quite a long time to explain. I mean, essentially, it's shall I go ahead?
Sure. Do you think it has to do with
talk
like
about this
Kevin McDonald in a way? And
I beg your pardon?
Because I know you have Kevin McDonald writes for Be There.
Yeah, I do. Kevin McDonald, and he's part of the explanation, but in some ways it's broader than that.
I think it's what I call in Alien Nation,
Hitler's Revenge, you know. I mean, the entire intellectual establishment of the First World, or at any rate, the Anglosphere, went overboard. They were so traumatized by the experience of fighting Nazism that they went overboard the other way. And they came to conclude that any expression of national identity or national existence was Nazism and had to be resisted. And you see, even now in Germany, I was actually talking to John O'Sullivan, the editor of the former editor of National Review just recently, and he lives in Hungary now, and he was telling me that he's been in Germany and he's talking to these people, you know, the Merkel people who've caused this great influx of Syrians and refugees and also other refugees under the rubric of Syrians into Germany. And he says, you know, that the German elite apparently is completely convinced that it has no right to Germany. They have no special claim over Germany. They have no more right to Germany than anybody else in the rest of the world. The way John puts it is, you know, that this is the second German genocide. First of all, they went after the Jews. Now they're going after themselves. So it's broader than the Kevin McDonald question, but the Kevin McDonald question,
sure.
You know, as you know, in vdare.com, we do publish Kevin and we have addressed him.
Yeah, your basic point, as you were saying earlier on the economics, it's redistribution of wealth from the middle class and the working class to both the new immigrants themselves and also the top 1% economically.
Right. That's right. I mean, you know, Robert, I came into the U.S. in 1970, and I sort of migrated not so much to the U.S. but to the American conservative movement, which I did regard, and I regarded then and I regard now, was one of the great flowerings of democracy. You know, I mean, it was an amazing thing, and it was because of that, that's what elected Reagan, and that's what ended the Cold War, defeated the Soviet Union. And all that time, the left was saying, well, this is just a racket. It's just an excuse for exploiting the workers and this, that, and the other. And we would always say, no, that's wrong for all kinds of very complicated reasons. But somewhere around about 1990, I came to the conclusion that whatever was the case, after the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, it did become a racket. It was an excuse for exploiting the workers. That's all the donors were interested in. They were interested in cheap labor, and they didn't care about anything else.
It's interesting because immigration restrictionist is seen as a kind of right-wing issue. I interviewed one of your writers on my site, a written interview with Randall Burns, and
oh, yes.
He makes the case against mass immigration from a more left-wing stance that immigration is bad for working class issues and environmental issues.
Yeah, Randall writes for us occasionally, and we're under the rubric of, I think, progressive perspective. You know, and I run vdare.com as a forum site, and I'll publish anybody who is critical of the post-1965 immigration disaster, regardless of what their other opinions are. And I don't want to hear what their opinions are. So, for example, periodically we get people who want to write about abortion for and against. And I do my best to keep them out of sight, because otherwise the coalition falls apart. We're only interested in the immigration issue. I've made vigorous efforts, by the way, to get gays to write for the site, because we have a lot of gay readers to support us. But that's a community with very, very tight discipline, and they're reluctant to do it because it causes, it's the effect of their social life. I had a guy who wrote for me, who used to write, correspond with me, used to sign himself out of the closet gay, in the closet immigration reformer. And you know, that's, I'm afraid that's very typical. So no, I mean, you can make an argument against immigration right across the spectrum. And of course, in the 1890s to 1920s, the impetus for immigration reduction came largely from the labor unions, because they could see it was busting down the incomes of their workers. And of course, Samuel Gompers was a major factor there, who was himself an immigrant, and they're also Jewish from Britain. The labor unions are completely in the hands of the left. I mean, they're basically run by apparatchiks, who you know, to use the Soviet term, who are just left-wing ideologues. That's why, of course, their members are voting for Trump, which they richly deserve.
Ah, so the heads are, you know, not working in the favor of the workers. The workers are rebelling and going for Trump.
Right. It's an example of the iron law of oligarchy. You know, all these organizations get taken over by self-interested elites.
You're seeing this kind of new political realignment, and you saw it in the UK with the Brexit, where Brexit succeeded in a lot of former working class labor strongholds. On the other hand, a lot of wealthy or conservative areas in the southeast of England voted against the Brexit. I do think we could see that same kind of political realignment here with Trump versus Clinton.
Right. I think they were wealthy areas, Robert, but I don't think they were conservative. These are not traditional conservative areas. They were traditional political conservative party areas, but they're not. They tend now to be run by the financial elite, and to a large extent the government elite and the academic elite. They're all the same. They're all the same group, and that's why you see if you look at the Brexit vote. You know, you see the university islands. You can see where the universities are in Britain because all of their staff and so on and all their hangers-on were voted for the European Union.
The managerial class.
Yeah.
It's what
Schumpeter called the new class, isn't it? The people who are actually dependent on a lot of it is what the new class, what people who depend on tax revenues, you know, on the exploitation of policy to the rent seekers. They successfully get to redirect tax monies towards favored causes.
With immigration, do you see the key issues as the numbers of people or the demographic composition of the nation or both equally?
Yeah, the answer is yes. I mean, as Enoch Powell used to say, numbers are the essence. You can handle any number of, you could probably handle small numbers of any type of group if they weren't big enough to make a huge difference to society. I think the problems right now with the U.S. immigration is the numbers are far too large. The population growth is really being driven by immigration, that is to say by public policy. The government has decided to second-guess the people, the American people, on population growth. If it was up to Americans, they would have stabilized the population. Fertility rates on all races in the U.S. have fallen to the point where they're just at the replacement level, so you have a stable population. But the government is second-guessing that by bringing in large numbers of a third world immigrants. That's one problem. But the problem is the skill levels are dramatically lower than they used to be. When I wrote my book Alien Nation in '95, the technical literature showed that there's never been a time when the skill levels of immigrants into the U.S. were actually below the skill levels on average of the native born. That's not what we hear about, but that actually was the case. But after the 65 Act, that went into reverse, and the skill was on average much lower, which was a big problem, especially because of the advent of the welfare state. I mean, as you know, you probably know, I used to interview Milton Friedman every year. And at one point he said to me, when I was at Forbes magazine, you can have mass immigration. You can't have mass immigration and the welfare state together. We've had mass immigration measures before at various times in the 1840s and then again in the 1890s through 1920s. I've had the welfare state really since the 1930s. We've never had both together. And it produces paradoxical incentives which we've never had to face before. And in fact, the political class is still not really thought through.
So what is the incentive for, you know, our elites to just keep bringing in more people and expanding the state? Don't they, this welfare state, don't they understand that it will inevitably bust?
What's the incentive? Who exactly did you say?
To just keep the doors open and keep bringing in more and more people while we have the welfare state.
I mean, the incentive for Democrats is very, very clear. For the left, it's very, very clear. They think it's simply going to create an election that will vote them into power. And they're very, very open about that. I mean, they're so unused to being criticized that they will openly say that demographic change is going to move us into get control of taxes and all this kind of thing. Demographic change means immigration.
So they just want a one-party state policy.
I'm sorry?
They want like a one-party state where just the Democratic Party is in charge.
Yeah, sure. That's what they think. And they no longer have to worry about arguing, about convincing people. If you look at demographic literature, for example, Stanley Greenberg's book on the Next America, or what it was called, I mean, they don't even pretend to be convincing people to vote Democratic. They're just going to import more Democratic voters. Now, of course, the owner of a serious massive apprehension here, which is that they're going to be able to hold this together. I mean, their coalition itself is subject to enormous strains. And we see this implicitly in the situation with the Democrats right now. I mean, the Sanders vote is fundamentally a white left-wing loony vote. And the Clinton vote is fundamentally a corrupt third world machine vote. Now, I think it hasn't fully played out that way yet. The full implication of this has not become apparent, but it is a problem for them, and it will become more apparent for them as time goes on. Now, the real question, of course, is, which I think is behind your question, is why are the Republicans doing this?
Yeah.
I mean, that is a profound question which needs a lot of thinking about. But one reason is it's just simply corruption. The party's in the hands of the donors. The donors are interested in short run profits from reducing labor. And I did these calculations. Ed Rubenstein and I have done these calculations on VDARE.com. You know, I mean, if you can just knock down the cost of labor, even a small amount, it's a tremendous windfall for the owners of capital. And that's what they thought they were going to get with the Gang of Eight bill and the various amnesty immigration surges that the Bush administration tried to push through. But on the other hand, it's quite clear this is political suicide. And what they think they're doing here is you know, is, as I say, it's a profound question. I've talked to these plutocrats. Because, of course, there's the financial journalist that dealt with
them. Neocon
a
types?
The actual plutocrats, the actual owners. And I mean, part of them are just sheer stupidity. They just simply don't think it through. I remember talking to a guy who was, he's a big Wall Street type, but he owned ranches in Texas, which happens to be where my wife comes from. And he was telling us that he can't possibly run his ranch without illegal immigrants from Mexico. Well, we said to him, of course, the real answer is, you shouldn't be running this damn ranch if it requires tearing the country apart to give you cheap labor. But what we said to him was, well, which way are these people going to vote that you're bringing in? And he said, well, why should I care which way they vote?
Yeah.
And the answer is, he should care which way they vote, because ultimately it'll lead to a socialist state. But they don't see that. They think that's far in the future. Maybe they think they can bribe their way out of it. Or maybe they're
just
stupid,
yeah.
You know. Maybe they're stupid. I mean, that's a very important factor in human affairs. I mean, if they rely for their intelligence, political intelligence on the Wall Street Journal, they're never going to hear this argument.
These people have a very short time preference in their mind. Like, they only think in terms of the next few months. They don't think in terms of
the next 10 or 15 years. Opposed to the whole conspiracy concept that there is this vast planned out. There's this vast plan.
It's just that these people barely think about the future at all.
Right. I just happened to finish listening to Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, you know, which I'm thinking about a great deal. And he did a very interesting thing, because he was able to basically rise to power in alliance with the Texas capitalists. One of the points that Caro makes, and I think Caro is a very simple-minded liberal, but one of the points he made in that book was, as long as Lyndon Johnson could periodically do things which it benefited Brown and Root and these various capitalist groups, in the short run, that they could actually see financial benefit from, they didn't worry about anything else. They didn't think about anything else. Didn't realize which way he was moving, you know, or what some of the other things he was saying were going to move the society. So I think you're right, they're very, very short term. And also,
yeah.
You know, they're insulated, they're immensely insulated. And one of the things about, who was it, who was one of the founders of Google, is now living in Singapore, has become a Singaporean citizen and renounced American citizenship, you know. They just don't have any feeling for the nation state. They're just rootless cosmopolites, basically.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember Steve Saylor saying something like someone like Angela Merkel only thinks in terms of like the next 3 days.
I'm sorry, who was this?
Steve Saylor said that about Angela Merkel.
Now, the Merkel case, I find really, really puzzling. I find that really puzzling, and I wonder, frankly, if to some extent we're not looking at some form of bribery. You know, maybe she thinks because she's going to be Secretary General of the United Nations, or you know, somehow I mean, really, the nightmare scenario for the U.S. is what happened to the South Africans, the white South Africans. And in that case, what happened, the capitalist class in South Africa was desperate for some kind of accommodation with the world, because he just basically wanted to continue exporting raw materials and so on and so forth. And he didn't care about what happened to the Afrikaner nation, which was the basis of the core of the political order there. And so, but the Afrikaners had successfully seized power in South Africa in the 1948 election. The Afrikaner nationalists who had fought the Boer War against the British Empire succeeded in both getting the vote on the way back into power. Over the next 40 odd years, they ran the society, but then suddenly they abruptly decide to give up their nation state, and I'm afraid the answer to that is simply bribery. I think the people at the top of the National Party in South Africa are simply bribed, and there weren't a lot of them, and there was a great deal of money involved, and I think it's really why the Republican Party refused to come out against immigration until Trump came along. Well, the answer is Shell and Adelson and the people putting money up for the campaigns and for the consultants and the directorships and so on. Afterwards, they're able to buy a political class. Now, what Trump has done is remarkable in that he's managed to vocalize, express the nationalist reaction to this transformation that's going on in the society.
Do you think Trump will make a major transformation in the direction of the Republican Party, or are you more skeptical of how successful he will be?
Trump? My opinion is, who the hell knows what he's going to do? But we did know what Jeb Bush was going to do. And we knew what Rubio was going to do, even though he had the grace to lie about it. So we're better off with Trump. For various reasons, I think there's a good chance he might actually do something. For one thing, I think he likes building things, and so I think the idea of building the wall is very attractive to him. And he doesn't seem drawn towards a quiet life. He seems to like, pitched battles. There's a tremendous amount he could do, actually, through executive order, legitimately, unlike Obama's executive orders, which are obviously illegitimate and far too, because they're far too sweeping. But he could do, the laws are on the books already, they're just not enforced. Robert, we just posted a thing on VDare.com this morning, a letter from someone saying, it's actually illegal to help illegal immigrants to stay in the country. So where the hell is the DNC getting off having all these illegal immigrants actually speak at their convention? They should all be in jail. The laws just aren't enforced. I mean, Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Hillary Clinton, everybody involved in organizing this convention should be in jail because they're obviously facilitating the presence of illegal immigrants in the country. They put them up in hotel rooms, they flew them there, all this kind of thing. That's all illegal. It's a felony. They show up in jail. The laws aren't enforced. Trump could enforce those laws if he felt like it. It's just a question of he doesn't have to pass any legislation, he just has to enforce the law. They could make a tremendous difference just by doing that.
Obviously, there's the issue of illegal immigration and the whole kind of debate between legal versus illegal immigration. How crucial is the issue of legal immigration, and what are some of the overall trends with legal immigration to the United States?
We've always been, and I've always been, in my book, I was always heavily focused on the issue of legal immigration. For one thing, it's larger than illegal immigration. Although not as much larger as you might think. I mean, net immigration, illegal immigration is huge, about 200,000 a year, and legal immigration is like a million or something. Basically, they're both out of control. Illegal immigration because people cross the border and they feel like it. Illegal immigration because it's driven largely by this family unification aspect of the 1965 law, whereby immigration is treated as kind of a bastard civil right, and immigrants who are in the country can then sponsor in their relatives. And there isn't a lot the Americans can do about that except slow it down. There are always quotas to how many get in any given year and so on. So they have these enormous queues of immigrants out there in the third world waiting to come in legally. And many of them subsequently just come in illegally because they assume they're not going to be thrown out. But I don't think illegal immigration is the real problem. It's legal immigration that's the real problem. In the end, that there's got to be an immigration moratorium.
Is it easier for people to come to third world than it is for people to come from even Canada? Because it seems like anyone I know who is like a European immigrant, they talk about this, you know, horrible process they've had to go through for years and years and years. And all these other people, you know, I wonder how they even got here, if they have they've gone through.
I heard Trump actually make the same comment in his CPAC speech from a couple years ago.
You're exactly right. Trump did make that comment, and it was extremely interesting that he picked that up. It's very, very the effect of the 1965 Immigration Act was to choke off immigration from the traditional sources in Europe and to reorient it towards a randomly selected, accidentally selected bunch of third world countries because through the family unification law. It's very, very difficult. This is why I don't like the term open borders. People saying that, the Democrats or the Jared Bush and so on, the people who are in favor of immigration, an open border status. We don't have an open border system. It's highly discriminatory. It's highly paradoxical, and it's difficult to get in legally. It's just out of control is the problem. It doesn't make any rational sense in terms of the national interest.
I can't find a link to this, but someone told me that in, I think it was in 98, Bill Clinton signed a deal with the European Union to limit immigration because the European Union was concerned about a brain drain because a lot of people would leave to the United States for lower taxes.
I've not seen that, and I don't think there's been major legislation to that effect. It's possible they could have tried to do it through administrative action. There's quite a lot of immigration policy that's just made informally through directions to the executive branch to either enforce or not enforce the laws. But I've certainly not seen that. I mean, the classic example of that, by the way, was, and this is one reason why I get much more skeptical about free trade than I was 20 years ago, is NAFTA. I mean, I remember when I was in about 1989, 1990, when I was a guy came to see me who'd been an economist from Mrs. Thatcher. He was the economist of Mrs. Thatcher at the time, and I knew him very well. And he'd been to see and he came in and said, he'd been in the White House, he'd been down to the people in the White House, he'd been briefed by what was going on. He said, you won't believe what they're saying. They're saying that we've told the Mexicans that NAFTA will actually increase illegal immigration, which is the direct opposite of what they were saying to the Republican faithful. And the reason for this was that, these trade deals, they're not actually, you don't really need a trade deal to go to free trade. Just go to free trade. What these trade deals actually are is agreements between various interest groups and who's going to get what. The trade-offs between who's going to get what. And what happened here was the American agribusinesses wanted to be able to export corn to Mexico. And the Mexicans had a system of corn price supports, which meant basically that they were subsidizing these relatively inefficient farms they had, these small farms they had in Mexico, which were keeping a lot of Mexican peasants on the land. And the Mexicans said, well, look here, if we abolish these corn price supports so you can sell the corn cheap into our market, it's going to throw millions of Mexican agricultural laborers off the land. And what are they going to do? They're going to come to these cities, we've got no work for them. What are we going to do? And the American negotiator said, that's okay, we'll let them in to the U.S. illegally. They didn't formally agree with the Mexicans that they were going to allow illegal immigration to increase. It was direct opposite of what they were telling the Republican faithful, who had been told that free trade was going to cause a Mexican growth and Mexicans were going to stay in Mexico. When you realize that kind of trade, where that kind of horse trading is going on, then you view these trade agreements very, very differently than you do just from a purely theoretical point of view. You're not moving to pure free trade, you're moving to some kind of crony capitalism.
You made an interesting point in your latest Ameren speech. You said that most of the demographic changes and population growth is driven by immigration. But if you look at actually birth rate trends, birth rates for minority groups are stabilizing after like a generation or so. So that's really the key issue is immigration. Are you a complete pessimist, or do you think a lot of these trends can be reversed?
I think trends can be reversed. I've given several talks which I've posted on video recently, saying that obviously I'm incredibly old, you know. Now I'm over 69 this year, and I've been involved in this a long time. And my experience is that I've learned that miracles happen quite frequently in politics. Nobody expected the Soviet Union collapse. Absolutely nobody. I mean, you know, I was there. I remember interviewing the Sovietologist. Nobody expected the Soviet Union collapse. Now, conversely, nobody expected the Afrikaners to capitulate either. So it works. It works both ways. And I think it's quite possible that demographic trends could reverse, and we could find ourselves in a much easier situation than we think we're headed for, as long as we can cut off immigration. But then again, I think that can be done. I mean, when I first started talking about this, you know, Trump hadn't emerged on the scene. Who expected him? And it's not like he's, you know, fire-breathing immigration restrictions. He's not at all. It's implicit. But nevertheless, he's obviously hit a nerve, and he's got the nomination, and I think there's an excellent chance he could win. So nobody expected that 2 years ago. So yeah, we could get lucky. We could get lucky. Because we could also get unlucky, so we have to prepare for that too.
Do you see conservatism as becoming obsolete and being replaced by something else, whether it's like a national populism or like a radical centrism?
I'm very reluctant to give up on the term conservative. I'm very attached to it because of, you know, having lived with it for a very long time, and at a time when it was very unpopular to be a conservative. And you'll remember that Lionel Trilling in the 1950s said there was no conservative tradition in American politics. They had no ideas at all. They just had emotional spasms that resembled ideas. So from going from that highly insulting level to Reagan and so on was, you know, it's something I'm reluctant to give up on. I do think that nationalism, I think that the word conservatism is too closely identified now with a whole series of wonkeries, which I would regard as a form of classical liberalism, and should more properly be assigned to the Democratic Party in the late 19th century, or Woodrow Wilson or something like that. You know, if people forget that the Republicans were always a protectionist party, it was the Democrats were a free trade party, and it was the Democrats who were an interventionist party. So the combination that we see under Bushism, interventionism and free trade, or at any rate actually managed trade, but still under the name free trade, that's really a typical Democratic party in the 19th century and the early 20th century, not a Republican thing at all. I agree with you that nationalism is I think the way forward. That's the way out of this dilemma. People need identity, and they'll fight and die for identity. Whereas some of these other issues are much more evanescent.
Well, you talk kind of about like traditional conservatism, and then to your average young person, they think of conservatism as like tax cuts for the rich, wars
right,
in the Middle East, and like the religious right type stuff. That's kind of your stereotypical image of a conservative. I do see a trend that could happen with Trump, and I also see it happening with Europe, where you do see this kind of a radical centrist nationalism. You even see it with Marine Le Pen, where you combine immigration. Well, you combine like immigration restriction and protectionism with a social safety net, some economic
regulation. So the centrism there is sort of economic. You're talking about a social democracy. Social democracy. Now, you see, that's exactly the formula that the British Conservatives came up with under Disraeli. They were all, you know, the Germans under Bismarck. They were the ones who introduced many of the features that we regard as typical of the welfare state today. They were nationalist and socially progressive, I guess.
And you see kind of
an
overall,
in some amazing way, Trump has blundered into that. I don't know how deeply he thought about this, but the fact that he recoiled from cutting Medicare and so on, Medicaid and all that kind of thing, whereas Paul Ryan wants to. In fact, it's all Paul Ryan seems to want to do. It's the same, and he instinctively reaching in the direction that you mentioned.
It's funny because all of the liberals will go and call Trump a fascist, but then all of the or an ultra conservative. I don't want to misuse the word. They'll call him like an ultra conservative, but
yeah,
all of the conservatives will call Trump a liberal.
Yeah,
so
somewhere on the side of discussion of what it means to be conservative, Trump gave an answer in New Hampshire which was really ridiculed, but actually I think was profoundly true. He said somebody asked him about how he defined conservatism or something, and Marco Rubio said it was a question of strong defense and free markets and something else that I forget. And Trump said he thought the word went back to the origins. Conservatism means to conserve, and we have to conserve the country. Now, that's a profoundly, it's a pre-modern conception of conservatism, that the fundamental point is to conserve the national community, and whether or not you have free trade is completely epiphenomenal. And
yeah,
he's right, they're wrong.
Modern
now, how the hell
he conserve
reached
nothing.
I'm sorry?
The modern conservative movement conserves nothing.
Well, no, that's right. I mean, and I very sadly come to the conclusion that I'm going to have to give up on the word, you know. Just as I was quite happy being a paleo-conservative until Richard Spencer came along and told me that was all a question of Catholicism and reactionary. That hadn't occurred to me. It was too close to identify with Chronicles magazine. That hadn't occurred to me. So I guess we have to give that up. And the same is true with conservatism. I mean, it's one of the very few cultural victories that the right has achieved, is that more people identify as conservative than liberal. But the problem with that, of course, is that you get all kinds of dross in there who simply use the term and then redefine it in their own way.
The idea that
conservatism has got anything to do with free markets, of course, is nonsense. It's alliance with free markets.
That's a liberal.
It's purely tactical.
I think the kind of a stigma towards conservatism ties in with the stigma towards immigration restriction. I think the majority of the public, they don't necessarily want mass immigration, but they kind of have this image of a stereotypical right-winger. I think if you had a coherent message where if you connected immigration to a lot of issues that progressives cared about, like workers' rights and the environment, I think that type of movement could be extremely successful, even if it was more like socially moderate and economically centrist. I think it's more kind of, I don't think it's that the masses want immigration. I think that there's just so much stigma towards being like a right winger.
Immigration restrictions there's nothing specifically right wing or certainly not quote unquote concerned about immigration restriction. It used to be in the 19th century there was the labor unions were opposed to it. Just as it was the labor movement that stopped Chinese immigration into California after the Civil War. It was a progressive. It was a populist. And if anything, a left-wing movement that simply didn't like workers' living standards being reduced. It's a great comment on the modern left that they never address this question. There's an operation called the Economic Policy Institute that we watch very closely because it discusses. It discusses wage levels and real income and all that kind of thing things that we're very interested in. But it turns itself inside out to face the fact that supply and demand applies in the labor market too. If you increase supply, you're going to reduce the price of labor. That's all there is to it. And they simply will not grasp that because, of course, it means that they have to break with the rest of the left-wing coalition.
I want to get your thoughts on the European migrant crisis. Obviously, in the news, there's been a lot of terrorist attacks. It seems to be now it's gone to the point where there's one a day. What are your overall thoughts?
Didn't Holland say that the French are just going to have to get used to this?
I think he did. What are your thoughts on the overall migrant crisis, and how would you compare Europe's situation to the United States? Do you think Europe is facing a much bleaker and a dire situation than we are?
Well, of course, the Europeans started off from a much better situation than the U.S. in terms of having, after the Second World War, you know, all the European nation states were relatively homogenous, which was not the case at the beginning of the 20th century. So they've had, really had to work to screw this situation up, but they've done it. And what Merkel did in inviting hundreds of thousands of quote-unquote refugees in really does require a lot of analysis. As to, I don't think anybody really understands quite why she did it and what she thought she was going to get from it. I will say that there are figures in sort of the international bureaucracy who have been urging this for a long time. For example, 2 or 3 years ago, a fellow called Peter Sutherland, who at one point was the Irish Attorney General and has been involved with the UN for many years, appeared before in the House of Lords committee and said that it's very important that the European Union, that the nation states not be ethnically specific. And he wrote an article saying that a great opportunity had been missed with the Arab Spring, because there was an opportunity to weave, to what he called weave together the populations on both sides of the Atlantic, both sides of the Mediterranean. Obviously, they decided not to miss this opportunity when the Syrian crisis broke out. So there are people, I mean, you know, paranoid enemies. There are people up there who are conspiring to do this kind of thing, and to basically abolish the nation states and reduce all of these societies to complete you know, dog breakfast with total ethnic confusion. Now, why they're doing this and who they are and what the motives are, you know, it's an extraordinary thing. I would never have thought that. I mean, obviously, we always knew that there were immigration enthusiasts, but we didn't quite realize how enthusiastic they were. Just frankly, when I wrote Alienation, published Alienation, I knew that American Jews generally were in favor of immigration, but I didn't realize how fanatical they were. We never realized, for example, that I had a number of conversations and dinners and so on with Norm von Horst, the editor of commentary, trying to persuade him to come out in favor of, incredible as it may now sound, incredible to come out in favor of immigration patriotism. I just simply didn't realize how deeply, deeply wedded he was.
How did he react to that?
The idea of deracinating the U.S.
How did those conversations go? Was he just shooting it down immediately, or he take the bait a little bit?
Well, you know, the one I remember I discussed in Alienation was when we brought in the Federation of American Immigration Reform. The head of that and his chief lieutenant, Dan Stein, and his chief lieutenant, Ira Melman, are Jewish. And Ira came up to New York, and we went to dinner with Norman, with John O'Sullivan, who was then the editor of National Review, to try to convert him on the subject. And it was kind of an amazing situation. I mean, every argument we raised, he said, well, I agree with that, I agree with that. But he still said he was still, you know, in favor of immigration. And we thought we'd made progress, but it turned out we hadn't. I mean, essentially, I don't think he was arguing in good faith. He had some kind of agenda which he wouldn't pass up to.
I think that wasn't it.
No,
like
no, I may say that. I've known Norman good Lord, since 1980. So how long is that? 36 years, isn't it? But in the last few years, he's refused to talk to me. Whenever I see him, he just turns away. You know, the emotion there is much more than I anticipated when I wrote my book. I knew it was bad, but it was quite as bad as it was. See this guy Brett Stevens at the Wall Street Journal, recently gave an issue, I think, saying that, well, because the Republican base has got to be taught that the Republican Party cannot be an ethno-nationalist party. Well, that's news to me. I didn't realize it could be an ethno-nationalist party, but apparently it's common wisdom for them.
That's what Zuhad said in New York Times. Is that what you just said?
Who said this?
Was it Ross Duhat, the conservative that writes for New York Times?
I'm talking about Brett Stevens of the Wall Street Journal, although I see David Brooks said a similar thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of funny. I think that they assume that the Republican Party has become ethno-nationalistic just because they've moved away from, you know, this open borders thing. It's like anything, any movement that Trump would make away from their agenda is
right.
the most extreme movement in their eyes.
Right.
They view him as, like, you know, full-on ethno-nationalist.
Right. I mean, the thing about Trump and McDonaldian terms is that, you know, he's implicit. Ethno-nationalist candidate. He isn't explicit. He doesn't say it. He doesn't say that he's exclusively interested in or primarily interested in white Americans or anything like that. It's just something that people deduce. And I think the distinction between implicit communities and explicit communities that McDonald makes is a very useful one.
So do you see that as the whole sort of a never-Trump crowd? And within the Republican Party, would you say immigration is exclusively the main quintessential issue that they oppose Trump, or do you think there's other factors too, like as a foreign policy?
I think foreign policy is for most of the Never Trumpers. I think for the neocons, it's foreign policy. They simply want to be able to have. I mean, bluntly, it's hard to get away from the idea that they simply want to be able to deploy the American military to defend Israel. I don't know that the Israelis want this. This is after the Israelis' view, but it's what the neocons want. I think, beyond that, I think immigration is the key issue because they've deep emotional reasons to the idea that the U.S. cannot be a traditional nation state. It's got to be some kind of proposition nation. And their commitment to that is far deeper and far more irrational and far more emotional than I anticipated when I wrote Alien Nation in 95. I mean, if you think about it, it's destroyed the conservative movement, and we had a well-organized and internally coherent operation that was going, and it was very successful in holding the party together and defeating the Soviet Union, and I really do think that's something that has to be credited for. But after that, it all fell apart, and this is the reason that they simply couldn't handle the one faction of it simply refused to handle the fact that resistance to the Soviet Union and to international communism is a real thing. I know nobody under 35 believes this, but it was a real issue. But the resistance to it was not simply ideological, but was simply ethno-nationalist, American patriotism. And they simply couldn't handle that.
What are your thoughts on the alternative right, and how do you see it as different than the paleoconservative movement, which you have been involved with, which existed long before the alt-right?
Well, of course, the alt-right is an astounding phenomenon, and both technologically and ideologically, and very happy to see it in existence, and I'm still grappling with it. John Derbyshire, this concept of the distant right, which is the right which is to the which is to the right of the establishment, and it focuses on issues like race and so on, which were simply driven out of public debate around about the time of the Civil Rights Act. So I guess I would view myself as a member of the distant right rather than the alt right, because the alt right is probably very closely identified with Richard Spencer and the right stuff and so on. But I think, you know, I'm looking for a more overarching term.
So, Peter, you know, you touched on the alt-right right there. And
yeah.
I was just curious as to what you think the future of the alternative right will be. I mean, I was reading this article on a site called Social Matter that I generally like. And this they were quoting that guy Menachus Moldbug. And he said that the U.S. population was split between, you know, the kind of Americaners, who I guess he kind of calls like the, you know, white proletariats. And then for the rest of the population, he puts them in the time machine, H.G. Wells brackets, of the Aloy and then the Morlocks. and basically, from there, it's like the writer goes on and says that you have all these people.
Oh, they just found
people.
This side. There's so many sides out there. Oh, I just can't.
Yeah, Social Matter is very, very good. It's very, really intelligent writers. But you know, I'm not just to try to wrap up what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You have these different kind of classes that are emerging. But I think the alt-right right now basically consists of people that have fallen out of that kind of Eloi category, or the SWPL, the stuff white people like.
Yep.
In the millennial generation, the people that have kind of realized that this kind of liberalism, progressivism is a bit, you know, a bit bullshitty. So do you think that more people will jump on that bandwagon and kind of embrace the white proletariat mindset, you know, and become immigration patriots? Or do you feel that that schism will go on for much longer, a kind of civil war within the white populace of America?
Putting aside the general truth that everything takes longer to happen than you think it's going to take, at least that's my experience, both in the stock market and in politics, I would say that you're right, that is inevitable, it's going to happen. If you were to express it in terms of psychology, in terms of voting patterns, you know, one of the things which I think has upset the left recently is that there's some academic work that suggests that as whites see, that is to say the people who until 1965 would have been called Americans, see that they're moving into a minority, they become more racially conscious and they vote more along racial lines. And that's what I expect to see happen. I expect to see, for example, that the great tier of northern states from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon, which are currently relatively, I guess the terminology is blue, although I don't like that terminology. I don't quite see how we got stuck with blue and red in the way we did.
It's the historical color of the right, isn't it?
A big one?
Isn't blue the historical color of the right?
Yeah. Color of the right.
Yeah.
Why did they decide the Bush states were red? But in any case,
Just to further shame the right.
I'm sorry?
Just to further shame the right.
These are states with substantial white populations. For example, my own state here in Connecticut. And they should be Republican states, but they're not right now for a variety of historical reasons. I think they will move in that direction. Ultimately, what's going to happen is we'll see a nationalizing of southern voting patterns where the whites all vote together. As you know, the demographics of Texas is no worse than the demographics of California. The difference is that in Texas, the whites have got the message and tend to vote together, whereas in California, they don't. So I do think that that's going to be an increasing tendency, I would guess, within the white community. I think the increasing reign of terror, of political correctness and so on the campus and so on, is because the left is well aware of this. They know they've got to prevent any type of white conscience developing at any cost, particularly while the whites are still in the majority, because they could easily organize and turn this all back.
So you see sort of the country becoming more polarized along ethnic lines and the divide between nationalism versus globalism. Do you see these other sort of left-right issues like the social culture wars and the economic left versus right divides? Do you see those issues as being put to the wayside?
It all goes back to what Lee Kuan Yew said, you know, the Prime Minister of Singapore. If you have societies that are deeply racially divided, in the end, all elections become tribal. People go to vote along tribal lines. Now, there are differences between the tribes, and I think that you will always find that the white tribe is more quote-unquote conservative in terms of its social values and so on than, for example, the black tribe is. Because in terms of marriage and legitimacy rates and so on, but fundamentally the vote will be along racial lines. That's why we're very concept of cultural Marxism on Vida. Excuse me. It is true that the left makes a systematic effort to find any single minority that he can and split it off from the white majority. That's why they work so hard on the gays.
And my question was that you said that the reign of terror of the left increases, you know, basically to stop any kind of white racial consciousness from emerging. But the way that I see this happening is that it becomes so powerful that it just becomes apparent what it is. And then, you know, you have websites like therightstuff.biz, and they're putting these parentheses, you know, like they've made that meme with the parentheses. and people are just putting it on themselves now. So for those, you know, who are not politically aware and they just go on Twitter and see this, it's almost just presented directly to them because the right has become extreme and the left has become extreme. It's sort of clear what it is.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that it's the battle lines have been drawn. That's right. And now the question is, you know, does that affect upper class children in these elite schools? And you know, I think the evidence there is mixed. I'm very encouraged. I'm very encouraged by the number of young people who are in the alt right. It's very interesting that they've reached this. But how the hell they've gotten there? When they look at the brainwashing and indoctrination and just sheer punishment, the coercion that they face, is a really interesting question. Perhaps you could answer that better than me.
I watched the Gavin McInnes show last year, and that's how I found out about you and a lot of other people. You know, then it just leads me down a rabbit hole while I'm, you know, reading Alain de Benoist and stuff like that that Gavin doesn't really touch on, but. You know, he opens the door.
But the thing is, it has to be done through the internet, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so this is the real problem. They're going to try and close the internet down at some point. They know that that's their enemy.
It's like what they did with cable TV. You know, when cable TV was first made available, people could get on easier. There's more public access, and you could make a show, and it wouldn't be the easiest thing in the world to get it out to the masses, but, you know, you could use public access.
Right.
And I think they're sort of, then they kind of clamped down and corporatized it. And I think they're trying to do the same with the internet.
Talk radio also. I mean, 20 years ago, talk radio was a really open forum, but now it's not.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Peter, is there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics before we wrap things up?
Do you feel that you've adequately addressed the Kevin McDonald question? Do you want me to talk about that?
I think that would be interesting.
The first thing about Kevin McDonald, who I'm sure your listeners know, is sort of an academic analysis of the Jewish role in society. The first thing to realize, of course, he's a man of the left. He came out of the left. He has no background in any of these sort of Judeo-critical literature, and he didn't know many of the major sources. For example, John Murray Cudahy, who wrote his book *The Ordeal of Civility*. McDonald didn't even know about it until he'd written his trilogy, *The Culture of Critique*.
He never even read the Old Testament.
I beg your pardon?
He said he never even read the Old Testament.
Right.
Before he was writing.
Right.
His
I mean, we published an article on vidar.com about his experience in the New Left with the SDS in the University of Wisconsin in the 60s. It's a very autobiographical article. I mean, he just seemed to get interested in these subjects all by himself. He's a very, very sweet guy and not at all contentious or confrontational. And I think he's paid a very high personal price for getting interested in these issues. The reason I ultimately decided to run his articles is because we're faced with this huge problem in the immigration patriot movement, which we used to call the immigration reform movement until the amnesty people stole the name. Which is, why is it that, you know, the great bulk of Jewish organizations, not I would say Jews per se, and certainly not individual Jews, but the great bulk of Jewish organizations, all of actually, were in favor of amnesty and massive increase in immigration. And so what's the explanation for this? And McDonald has a theory about it. He thinks that he has a kind of a social biological explanation for it, that it's a question of an in-group and an out-group, and they're competing for control and that kind of thing. And I think it's an argument. So I ran it. I ran his articles on this. His first article was on whether neoconservatism could be viewed as a Jewish movement or not. He came to the conclusion that it could. But as he said, it's an argument that's open to refutation and reasoned refutation. It's just his hypothesis. In any event, the result for us was catastrophic, because we were immediately denounced by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate
group. Oh, that's what got you on their list?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was. They had another excuse, but it happened immediately after we first ran Kevin MacDonald. And that, in turn, totally dried up our mainstream media contact. I mean, it's hard to believe now, but in the 90s and the early part of the aughts, you know, I was often called to appear on mainstream media forums as a proponent of immigration reduction, because you know I had these very established journalism credentials and so on. Now they didn't like it because, of course, it turned into a fist fight, which I always won, in my opinion. But still, until they named us as a hate group, we were still invited, and my writers were invited, VDare.com writers were invited onto mainstream media forums. Then it all came to a screeching halt. There's obviously a blacklist out there. But I still think that, and we have run MacDonald on a number of things. I mean, he's currently, we have a series discussing the Jewish attitude to Trump. Trump is a really interesting case, of course, because his daughter is a convert to Judaism, and his children have been raised, I believe, Orthodox Jewish. And
yeah,
he's been
Orthodox
up to his
Jews,
Jews all of his life, you know, in the New York City real estate business. And you know, he's very, very well known to the Jewish community, as we've published quoted articles making this point. But he's still under suspicion. So MacDonald's analyzing that. But I guess my basic point is, we're allowed to talk about this, aren't we? We can't claim that it's not significant. It's highly significant in American debate. What the Jewish organizations think, and so we want to analyze it, and we want to discuss it, and that's all there is to it. And you know, one of the great things about not being fired from National Review and not working in mainstream media anymore is that I'm allowed to write about it. We're allowed to publish this stuff. I'm not saying that MacDonald is necessarily right, but I do think he's rational, and he's subject to dispute. Like when we first started publishing him, after a while we got one of we have a lot of Jewish writers and a lot of Jewish supporters, and one of them wrote me and said she didn't like this MacDonald stuff, this sort of evolutionary psychology explanation of what the Jewish organization were doing. She thought the explanation was much simpler than that. She thought that Jewish intellectuals were all mad. That was her explanation.
Wow. Crazy?
She just thought they were crazy, yeah. That was her explanation. Jewish intellectuals were all crazy. She's a Jewish intellectual herself. Well, that's what she thought. That was the view. Which is not an uncommon opinion, by the way, as I'm sure you know, among Jewish intellectuals. So, there we are. And I intend to continue for Mr. MacDonald, and we intend to, I guess that means we're not going to appear on what the hell's that PBS show called? The Manil, it used to be called Manil. Yeah, we're not going to be invited to appear on there, but you know what? I don't care. I'm too old. I don't care. does that strike as an unreasonable position?
Yes. Definitely.
I mean, that's it. I mean, are these things subject to reasoned debate or not? That's what I think the issue is.
We are out of time. I would like to thank Peter Brimelow for being on the show. It's been an excellent interview.
Well, thank you for having me, gentlemen. I really appreciate it. And Alex, thank you for starting the Trump chant. That was really interesting.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for publishing the article. Thank you very, very much. It's been an honor.
Great. Keep it up.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Thanks, gentlemen.